Sure, we need business to keep the aeroplanes going and to pay the mortgage and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, my motivation and where my journey is going is that I really think I've found what I want to do is I want to help as many pilots be safer and better pilots.
Welcome aboard the High Fly Media podcast, dedicated to sharing the stories and experiences of the amazing people who make aviation happen. From pilots like me to engineers, air traffic controllers and others, I'll explore their personal journeys, the challenges they've faced and the triumphs they've achieved. My name is Damien and I'll be your host. Whether you're a seasoned aviation enthusiast or new to the field, I invite you to join me as we take off on this journey of discovery. Today we have a special guest, Paul Strike, who has had an incredible journey in aviation. Paul's passion for aviation began as a young cadet in the Royal Australian Air Force. He then went on to join the Air Force, mustering as an avionics technician. It was around this time that Paul also learned to fly gliders. With his wealth and experience in aviation, he's worked all over the world and is now, among other things, the brainchild of Bad Attitude Advanced Flight Training, which specializes in upset prevention and recovery training. We're excited to have Paul on the show today as he shares his insights and stories about his career and his future in aviation. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the fascinating world of aviation with Paul Strike. G'day, Paul.
G'day, Damien.
It's been many years since we've had kind of significant contact, and I went back through the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast archive and found where I'd interviewed you before.
Mm-hmm. That was a long time ago.
And if I remember correctly, we were in the next room and you had just taken on a banner towing organisation called Flying Signs, which is still run today.
Yeah, that was an exciting time. Karen had a commercial pilot's license from Canada. When we came over to Australia, she wanted to convert to a commercial license. And it was funny because I said to her, oh, you know, commercial license, grade one, class one medical and, you know, higher standard. And we were still finding our feet here in Australia. And I said, oh, why don't you just get like a private and then, you know, that'll be a little bit easier. And she rightfully so. No, I worked hard for my commercial license. I want to get a commercial. And I was working up in Papua New Guinea at the time, fly in, fly out, looking after Dash 8s up there. We had a discussion about it and I said, well, you know, if you want to get a commercial, the only way we could probably justify spending that sort of money to transfer that is if you had a job to go to. So I went up to PNG for my 28 days on. When I come back, there was an ad for a Beneteau business for sale.
Mm.
So we sort of said, okay, well, there you go. I had a private license at the time.
Yeah.
And I went, well, the pressure's on me now because I want to be part of this too. So I quickly went and did my 7 subjects.
Yep.
Which was really, I did it in a pretty short period of time because I was up in PNG, fly in, fly out. So I had plenty of time up there to do what I needed to do.
Yeah.
And so it was a pretty good journey. And by the end of it, Karen was flying banners and I was flying banners. And that's where I met you because I'm not sure how we actually found each other.
But yeah, I got a phone call from Steve Vischer from Plane Crazy Down Under. And he said, Damien, he said, I'd just agreed. So I'd actually been on the podcast when I was going through my commercial. And that interviewed me and they ended up saying, hey, do you want to be our northern correspondent in case we've got
an interview? That's right, I remember, yeah.
So I think they'd come across Caribou Cargo.
Right.
And said, go and interview this guy for Caribou Cargo. And there was a flying event on that day. I remember going up in a Antonov, a big yellow biplane.
All right, AN2, yeah.
Yeah. And among other things on the day. And that's when we first met. We recorded that interview that day. And then I remember coming down because it was a different day when you pulled the first banner.
Yeah.
And I brought the camera down and took some photos of that, which I think are still on your website.
Absolutely they are. That black and white one was
the
really good one. Yeah.
So flyingsigns.com.au, still
That's
alive.
It. Still yeah. alive.
And I saw, because I follow you on Facebook, I saw recently one photo that really captured me was a proposal where this boyfriend and girlfriend hiked up Mount Flinders and there was Juliet India Romeo with the you know, I can't remember the name, Will You Marry Me banner behind it. And yeah. I was just like, oh, that is so cool.
Yeah. I've proposed to a lot of women over the years. And we're batting 100%.
Nice.
So,
yeah, nice. There you go, gents. If you want to, if you're in Southeast Queensland and you want that 100% strike rate.
There you go.
That is so cool. So, as a young fella, you were a cadet?
Yeah, I was in the cadets.
So, you obviously had an interest. What sparked the interest in aviation in the first place?
The earliest memory I have is my dad was in the army. He was a Vietnam vet. And thanks for your service, all those people. And he was in the three-quarter cav up in Townsville. And we went to a Christmas party. And I remember Santa coming in a Kiowa. I didn't know it was a Kiowa at the time, but I just remember Santa hanging out the side of this helicopter. And I just went, that is so cool.
Mm.
Now, I've had I've flown a couple of helicopters. I don't have a helicopter license, but I've been fortunate enough. I had an interesting little exercise up in Canada, up in near the Arctic Circle. We're up there doing some work. And in a little camp, and the helicopter pilot that was there, he said, "Oh, have a go at this. You know, you fly fixed wing, see how you go with this." So we're flying down this runway in near the Arctic Circle, and he said, "Oh, what I want you to do is because I was flying it okay." He says, "Oh, you fly this okay? Let me step it up a little bit." And he wanted me to fly hover along the runway in one direction, and then whilst moving along the runway in one direction, do a 360 degrees.
Like a pirouette.
Like a 360 degree turn. There's probably a fling wing type of
word for it.
For sure.
What's aviation? There's probably an acronym for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's probably hold my beer, watch this.
Yeah.
We're going forward and I got to 90 degrees and I just could not bring myself to make this machine go backwards. I said, I can't do this.
Unnatural.
Yeah, it's just not happening. But I remember Santa hanging out of that. And then from that, I said, I'm really interested in that. So Dad got me into the cadets in Townsville. And all organizations are very different when you look back at it. You know, in your 50s or 60s, and you look back and go, oh, it's a different Air Force, or it's a different Army, or it's a different cadets program, or if it's different, it's a different riding club, or it's a different sailing club, or whatever. It's just the growth of things. But, you know, the organization, it just cemented stuff in me, you know, having a military, my dad in the military, and then I did 16 years in the Air Force, and that the Air Force gave me a really good baseline, a good foundation to learn more, because I look back now at the when I got out of the Air Force, because the Air Force has a very different certification type of a structure where no task is ever done by one person. It's always have a second inspection and then maybe a third inspection.
Right.
So when I got into the civil world, I remember up in Canada when I got my AME license in Canada, and I had to do all the exams, and I showed them my record of training and employment in the Air Force, and they recognized my training, but they said, you got to do all our exams and you have to do 12 months on the job experience in Canada. And then, so I ticked all the boxes and got the ticket. And I remember working for this small operation, the boss come in and goes, "So I hear you got your license." "Yeah, yeah." He goes, "Good. There's an aeroplane out there with something broken. I want you to go out and fix it." And my first thing was, "Okay, is anybody coming at me? You got a license? Get out there. The plane leaves in 10 minutes. Hurry up, get out there and do it." And that was like the baptism by fire into the civil world. It's just like, it's snowing outside, it's minus 25, the plane's broken, it's got to leave in 10 minutes, get it done.
Yeah, right. Very different culture to the Air Force.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, it was.
So I know from our past chat that you spent a little bit of time working for a very famous airline that has to do with buffaloes.
Yeah, Buffalo Air up in Yellowknife.
Northwest Territories.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was working in the Middle East on a contract. When I got out of the Air Force, I I went to Oman and got a job for the Oman Air Force and was very fortunate to do a project in maintenance control, taking the whole Air Force from a paper card system to a full electronic maintenance planning and tracking system. Was really, really interesting and challenging. But when it came towards the end of a contract, I'd met Karen and said, oh, we'll go and work in Canada. It was really funny because I was over there on a holiday from the Middle East, and Karen and I went for a drive up to Yellowknife just to have a look and see what it was like. And it was in the summer, of course, so it wasn't too arduous.
Yeah, wasn't covered in snow.
Yeah, it wasn't minus 40. But went and had a look at this organization that was setting up a school, AME school for engineers. And I got offered the job, and I don't know whether it was because I was probably the only one stupid enough to go up there to do it, but the principal of the school said he was very impressed that we actually travelled up to Yellowknife to have a look at what was on offer and have a look at the place. Working for Joe was in Joe's organisation was really an interesting experience. The aeroplanes up there are beautiful, if you like radial engines and all that sort of stuff, although I believe Joe's got into Electras now, so
right.
Turboprops. But, the C-47s and the DC-3s and the DC-4s and really, really nice stuff. And keeping the nostalgia alive, really great. So it was a really nice time up in Yellowknife. I spent 4 years up there, but looking back at it now, I'm glad I did it in my 30s and not now. It's a very harsh environment.
Yeah.
And looking at just putting an aeroplane to bed and waking it up in the morning with engine blankets and tennis heaters and cockpit heaters and everything like that. Australia, it's a doddle. Go and take the pedo covers off and, take the chocks out.
Yeah.
Don't have to walk around on an icy wing, shoveling, brushing snow off of it and all that stuff.
Southeast Queensland, you rarely need to put carb heat on when you're on.
Yeah.
When you're coming in on final.
Yeah, that's right.
So from what I've been gathering in my investigation and leading up to talking to you today is that your passion has, I'm not going to say shifted, but probably narrowed in or focused in on the upset prevention and recovery training. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think so. We were just talking offline how some people travel through life, they don't really know what they want to achieve in life or what they want to do. I've been very fortunate because the way that my brain's wired, the way I was brought up by my dad, it was all very structured and one of the biggest things that I've found, I started flying in 1985, so what's that? It's nearly 40 years.
Yeah, nearly.
There have been many, many people along the way who helped me do things. And same with Karen. She talks fondly of people in Canada who helped her achieve things that she wanted to achieve. And we're all on the journey. And I was just thinking, I was only thinking a couple of days ago, here I am a grade one flight instructor and doing all the things that I'm doing now. And I think back to when I was, 1985, 86 and all the aspirations and, you're 18, 19 years old or whatever. And I'm going to, what's my plan for world domination? I'm going to take this thing and ride it to the moon. And I remember looking at those grade one instructors and all those sort of things. And they were like heroes to me. It's just like, oh, wow. Somebody says, oh, did you fly with, Jack Edwards? Jack Edwards at the Point Cook Aero Club. He's a legend. Yeah. Oh, Jack Edwards sent you solo. Oh, yeah. You must be okay if Jack sent you solo, So, and now I are one,
Yes. You're someone's hero.
Well, I don't propose to be anybody's hero, but the thing is that people help me.
Yeah.
And now Karen and I, we quite often say, you know, we are in the enviable position to be able to help other people.
Mm.
And it's really interesting because the flight training syllabus says you must taxi an airplane, you must perform turns, you must climb, you must do, but there's thousands of ways of baking a cake and it all turns out to be a cake. It's just that some people's cakes are better than other people's cakes. And you know, I'm not professing that the way that we teach people to fly is any better than anybody else's. This is just the way that we've manifested our process here. And when I see, when you travel along the journey and you live long enough in aviation to have made mistakes and see other people make mistakes, there are things that you do and you don't do. And when people come to fly from scratch with us, we want to instill that culture of, you know, doing it the right way that's safe and efficient. So when people are out there free from the nest, so to speak, that they're making good informed decisions. And then when you get people, particularly when we're doing tarwheel endorsements or aerobatics or formation or even a flight review, somebody comes in and, you know, well, show me a straight ahead stall or show me a this or show me a that. And they do something that you've observed and you understand that is not right because that's going to end in tears in the right conditions.
Yeah, right.
And then you go, why did you do it that way? Oh, my instructor told me this. Okay, did you consider this? So I don't really ever want to be critical of another instructor teaching the way that they do.
Mm-hmm.
We just like to give people a different point of view.
Yep.
And one of the classic ones without doing a flight lesson is where, say we take somebody in the 172 and we're doing a flight review or whatever. And I say, okay, we'll just do an approach and a landing, you know, the way you've been trained to do it. And we're on a 3 mile approach with 40 flap at 2300 RPM on the 3 degree profile in a VFR 172 with a wind that's 15 to 20 knots. And then you let them go and they do the job as best that they've been told to do. And then I just say, well, my controls for a sec, let me just show you a different way. And then we position ourselves so that we do an approach at idle with the appropriate flap, with the appropriate speed and all that sort of stuff. And they say, oh, that was very different. Why would you do that? And I said, well, you're in a position where at 2 miles with all that power, with that flap, if you have an engine failure, you're never going to reach the runway.
Mm.
Whereas if you plan your circuit with this, then if you have an engine failure, you're going to make it,
yeah.
You know, and ask them the question, you know, like, what would you do if you're 2 miles and you have an engine failure? I get two basic responses. One is I'll raise the nose to stretch the glide. Sorry, that's the wrong response.
Mm.
And the other one is, well, I'll have to lower my nose to maintain my airspeed. Okay. So where's your threshold going to end up?
Yeah.
Or way up there. So I never try to teach people, if they want to fly our airplane, they have to be able to fly the airplane the way we want them to fly the airplane because that's our prerogative. We pay the insurance and we take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
Karen and I like the idea of going home every night comfortable that whoever flies our airplanes have the best opportunity in our mind that they're going to bring the airplane home safe and themselves safe.
Mm-hmm.
That's the number one is the pilot home safe and we can reuse the airplane. But if somebody's just coming for a flight review or whatever, they're on their journey and the best I can do is, are they safe? Are they familiar with the regulations? Do they meet the requirements? And have I given them something to think about when they leave?
Mm.
Because we've had a few people that come in for a flight review and they say, oh, it's really refreshing to actually get taught something and not just fly around with somebody for an hour and scribble in the book and pay some money.
I can give you two experiences. One was when I did my instrument rating flight test. So I'd done plenty of instrument flying to get to that point. And then I went out on the flight test with a testing officer by the name of Alan Dunbar. And we took off from Archer Field in the Dutchess and we flew down to Lismore, which I'd done, I don't know how many times, you know, in preparation for that test. And we did the approach into Lismore and then took off, and he said, just fly to the south of Lismore, want to do some unusual altitude recovery. Well, you had done plenty of that before, you know, under the hood, whatever. And all of my training to date had been, whether it was, you know, as part of my GFPT or whether it was as part of the private or commercial training, and definitely the instrument rating training, was, okay, shut your eyes. Aircraft goes into an unusual altitude because of the instructor. Okay, open your eyes, recover. Alan didn't do that. He said, pull your pen out of your pocket. And so I took it out of my pocket, my top pocket, and he said, drop it on the ground. I dropped it on the ground. He said, okay, pick it up. And just the nature of me like leaning down to pick it up, I put the airplane into an unusual altitude. And he said, okay, recover. And then I had to recover the aircraft. And so he did that, and he did a couple of other things that were kind of similar, which would be reflective of something that would actually happen in real life. And it just really opened my mind up to, as a student, but on a flight test, as to, oh, okay, this is why I've been doing this. It's not necessarily because I'll have unbalanced equilibrium or whatever. It's because I've dropped my pen, something real simple that I'd never thought of.
Yep.
And the other was my last, you know, my last being like nearly 10 years ago, BFR that I did with a chap by the name of Paul McEwen, who used to fly for Virgin.
Yeah, I know Paul.
You know Paul?
Yeah, well.
So Paul took me up and we flew out of Gympie and we flew down to Maroochydore. He was pretty chuffed because, and I video recorded the flight, so I've still got the footage somewhere, because we held up a Jetstar plane that had to wait for us to do a touch and go. And then I had, like, that flight was, what, about an hour? And I had, I don't know how many practice force landings on that flight, because it would have been upwards of 10.
Wow.
Practice force landings, even to the point where we did some touch and goes back in Gympie, and I was in the circuit, as you normally would be on downwind. Okay. And he says, engine out. And I had to do a circling approach right from about halfway down, or maybe a bit further than halfway down downwind. So I wasn't a beam the numbers yet, but had to do a circling approach from there. And I remember him saying, you need to talk to the owner of this aeroplane about its reliability, because he'd given me so many engine values on the flight. Yeah. But once again, it was just that reality check on this can happen at any time and what's your best option and so on and so forth. So, yeah, that's really commendable.
Yeah. So getting back to your actual question.
Yeah, about bad attitude.
Yeah, so bad attitude come about. You know, it's got that twist on it, because you can get in trouble from bad attitude.
Mm-hmm.
First found out about upset prevention and recovery around about 2014. And it was because I watched a video from the NTSB, and it was an all-day seminar. The video at the time went for 8.5 hours, and the job I was doing at the time, I was employed to be a coiled spring, so I had a bit of time just sitting there waiting for something to break, and if nothing broke, it was entertain yourself. So I watched this thing all day, and it had Paddy Wagstaff in it, and it was about loss of control. And I didn't know much about it, like aerobatic endorsement and all that sort of stuff, but there's, you know, this loss of control. And right at the end, they were talking all about angle of attack, and angle of attack is something that a lot of people don't understand. A lot of pilots don't really understand angle of attack. And we've learned so much from the Wright brothers, and that's a whole nother chat. They invited these guys from university, some young gents, who were designing a device that could attach to the aeroplane that would Bluetooth transmit a head-up display in your glasses that would tell you what your angle of attack is, so that while you're in the circuit, you could be scanning for traffic rather than have an angle of attack indicator on the dashboard, so that you could turn and look for traffic and you would still have this angle of attack information in a heads up. And the guy who was facilitating the discussion said to Paddy Wagstaff, what do you think of that, Paddy? And she said, that's wonderful. It's very technologically advanced and it's probably, you know, going to be very handy for people. But why don't we just teach people to fly the aeroplane properly?
Hmm.
And that was a pivotal moment in my life, because I went, wow. Because I at the time I was teaching design features, flight activities, you know, aerobatics, spinning, formation, tailwheel, manual propeller, retractable, all that stuff. And I said, why don't we teach people to fly? So I did some more research and found an ICAO document, ICAO Doc 111. It's 10011. And it's a light toilet read. It's only like a few hundred pages. And it was mainly targeted at airlines. But it, with this job that I had the opportunity to dissect that. And I did research, what does CASA say about it? Zippo, except for airlines. What's the FAA say about it? Zippo, except for airlines. What's EASA say about it? And at the time, Zippo, except for airlines. And then one of the triggers for this ICAO document was Air France 447 and the Coughlin accident. And again, angle of attack, you know, Air France 447. I don't understand it. I'm holding the stick all the way back, but we're still going down.
Mm.
Wow. Stall stick position. That's a new, you know, phrase for the 21st century. We didn't get taught that back in the 80s and 90s. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that we've learnt, but we're still teaching the old ways.
Mm.
And in one of the videos that I've put on Bad Attitude on the Facebook page is I was doing spin endorsements for an operator on the Gold Coast for all their trainee flight instructors. There's a regulatory requirement to have a spin endorsement. And we're up there, and I said to this one young fella, why don't you patter me through a wings level straight ahead 1G stall and stall recovery? And he verbalized the whole thing as an instructor would from back in the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
because he's rote learned the process and he's studied it, and that's what his instructor told him to do and all that sort of stuff. And he did okay. He did a pretty good job. And I said, that was pretty good, except you never said the words angle of attack once, not once. And that's why the wing stalls, is because of angle of attack. Doesn't stall because of speed. Doesn't stall because of anything except we exceed the critical angle. And I go through, we'll do a flight review, ask a lot of people, you know, show me a wings level 1G straight ahead stall recovery. And I actually made another video. There's another video, the five most inappropriate stall recoveries.
Mm-hmm.
It's the five stall recoveries that I got to make sure I'm prepared for, because people will do it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them's called the Neil Armstrong, where they stall the airplane straight ahead and then punch the stick fully forward and you get negative G.
Mm-hmm.
And then while we're pointing straight down, they put full power on. So that's one of them. And there's the others. So I started to go, I'm amassing this knowledge. I'm doing all this research. I'm finding out this to help make people better, and then make them better pilots, make them safer pilots. Now, I'm not on a crusade. We are doing what we're doing, and we deliver the content. And if people want to come here and they can learn. And if they don't want to come here, they don't have to come here. It's pretty simple. But I'm amassing this knowledge and going out and practicing this stuff and going, well, holy crap. Because I go out in the decathlon, and we're very fortunate we've got a decathlon, and I can pretty much do whatever I want without fear of breaking the aeroplane or myself. And just look at, okay, what if this happens? Oh, yeah, okay. So out there practicing stuff and say, this does not work. So when you're in a Cessna, now you get pretty hard to get in trouble in a Cessna. Cessna's been built to make it easy to learn how to fly.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many built-in stability features on it. But the problem is that somebody goes and does their flying in a Cessna, and then they go and buy an RV and handle it the same way as they handle a Cessna, and they're going to find themselves upside down or in trouble. And the thing about upset recovery is if you put the wrong inputs in at the wrong time, you're going to exacerbate the situation.
Yeah.
So one of the things, and it's been a building thing over time, to come up with a syllabus of training, because there's nothing down at our level. And one of the things that come out of, you know, like Air France and all that sort of stuff, is that identifying that and talking to like Virgin and Qantas and those big airlines, what's the problem? The same sort of problem that your GA operators, your entry-level GA operators like Air Frontier up in Darwin, talk to the guys up there. What are you looking for? As a training organization, we're providing you a product, which is a commercial pilot.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing or what aren't you seeing? What do you need from us? Sure, there's the syllabus, but what are you finding? And the overbearing response is just give me a commercial pilot who can fly a circuit safely without trying to destroy the airplane.
Wow.
And on top of that, it's the culture and leave their phones at home. They don't have to watch YouTube all the 24/7 a day, whatever. But overall, flying schools are producing a pretty crap product.
Mm.
And we need to work on that. So I'm amassing all this information. And when I get people, and it's not regulated, UPRT is not regulated
right.
at our end. Spent a number of years with RAOs, with Neil Schaefer and Jill Bailey, working on how we can better teach the syllabus subjects to include elements of loss of control prevention. Can we change the way we teach? We don't want to change the syllabus. The syllabus is there, but the syllabus says you must be able to stall an airplane. Now, the Part 61 syllabus for GA says that there are five stalls that you must be trained in. And the only one that everybody remembers is the wings level 1G straight ahead stall. And that's not the one that's going to kill you.
Mm.
It's the stall and a turn. It's the stall in landing configuration. These are the stalls and nobody remembers them. So I've got a lot of Pepsi Max owing to me because I bet Pepsi Max. So I'll take a student out. So say, for example, we're doing a tailwheel endorsement.
Yeah.
Upper air work for the first lesson to show them adverse yaw and do a stall and get them comfortable flying the aeroplane before we get into the circuit work. And yeah, show me a wings level straight ahead stall recovery. How's he going to kill me today? Okay, he didn't do the Neil Armstrong. He did the clock watcher, blah, 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 blah. Okay, we got that. That's all good. And then I say, what's going to happen if we do a stall and a turn? And 90% of the time the response is, oh, we're going to spin. Really? Bet you a can of Pepsi Max we don't. And they go, oh, yeah, right on. Yep, no worries. I've never had anybody pay me yet, but I go, okay, your job is to keep the ball in the middle and I'm going to put it in a 20 degree angular bank turn and you're going to keep the ball in the middle and I'm going to use the throttle and the stick and I'll stall the airplane. You just keep the ball in the middle and the airplane pitches up, exceed the critical angle of attack, nose pitches down, apply power, change the rudder from left to right, climb away. And most of the time the response is, wow. We didn't drop a wing or anything.
Mm.
Correct. Now we're going to do the same thing, except I want you to skid the aeroplane half a ball out. Now the decathlon, we've got JIR trimmed very, very nice. Half a ball out, do exactly the same exercise, it'll roll on its back.
Yeah, wow.
And I do that with, if anybody wants to do a flight review on the decathlon, I'll do the same exercise in that. And invariably, most of the time, people say, I learned a lot about how important it is to keep the ball in the middle.
Mm.
And that's very important. So the reason why I'm sort of reflecting on this is because it's not regulated. There are people out there advertising, we deliver UPRT. And there are some people that are doing it good, and there are some people who are not. And in particular, I had one young fella come, and he'd done 5 hours of UPRT with another provider, and he wanted to do a tailwheel endorsement. So tailwheel endorsement, do the brief, upper air work, show me a stall straight ahead. Whoa, holy crap. What's with the Neil Armstrong? What's going on? He goes, oh, was that bad? I don't know, mate. You've just done 5 hours of upset recovery. You tell me if it's that bad.
Hmm.
And okay, show me a skidding turn. Show me a skidding turn. Oh, no, mate, that's a slipping turn. You need to show me a skidding turn. So unable to identify the difference between a slip and a skid, unable to identify how to recover from a stall appropriately, couldn't identify. I said, what's more dangerous, a skidding turn or a slipping turn? Slipping turn, 50-50 chance, mate, you blew it, sorry.
Mm.
So it got me thinking. I'm just like, what the hell? There's all these people paying money to go and do training.
Mm.
that's giving a negative outcome. So I did an invitation to all people who I could find in Australia who were advertising that they did UPRT and said, come to Caboolture on the 1st of August last year and let's sit in the room and have a chat about it. And I had like 28 people register. Wow. Some came from Sydney.
Yeah.
Some tuned in online.
Yeah.
Some of those webinars that I did that are copied onto YouTube on the Bad Attitude YouTube channel, I've had people tune in from the UK, Norway, US, Canada, South America, just people who are interested to learn more, you know, who've got a thirst for knowledge. And we sat around and said, what are we doing here? And CASA bought delegates. They bought three delegates from the cell that's looking after upset prevention, mainly for the airlines. And then we were invited to go to the CASA UPRT workshop in Sydney. And this is where we're in the room with Qantas and Virgin. And there was another UPRT provider there and RAOS was there. And it was a one-day workshop. And all three of us, RAOS and two UPRT providers at the GA level spoke, which is a lot of time in a one-day seminar for airlines and stuff like that, which really made me think that CASA is really taking it seriously because if we can provide a better product to GA, provide a better, not just a commercial pilot, but a better private pilot or a better recreational pilot and a safer recreational pilot by just teaching them terms like unload the wing. What are you talking about, unload the wing? Well, when you pull them back on the stick, you're loading the wing. Just unload it. It's the G that's causing the problem. If you're pulling G, you're increasing angle of attack, you're creating more lift, so you're loading the area. Unload or stall stick position and, you know, balance. And we need to be using these terms as normal everyday talk in aviation.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a couple of workshops and trying to formulate some sort of cohesion and CASA's looking to the industry to help them develop what should be in the UPRT syllabus. But the smoking gun is the flight instructors. If we don't teach flight instructors how to deliver the training appropriately, it's just a waste of time.
Well, you're going to be getting the dribs and drabs as they're interested, right? People like me, the private pilots that go, oh, I want to make sure I don't die. I'll go to this training. But like you say, if you're training those who are training, then everyone that comes through that process is going to get taught. That's awesome.
Yeah, to a degree, that's exactly right. Because human beings are interesting animals. You know, when you're trying to, sure, we need business to keep the aeroplanes going and to pay the mortgage and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, my motivation and where my journey is going is that I really think I've found what I want to do is I want to help as many pilots be safer and better pilots so that they can live longer. And I want to give back to people who helped me in the past and who helped Karen in the past. And you know, it might just be sitting at the table with chips and beer after flying and just saying something, because you learn more sitting around the table drinking chips and beer than you do in the aeroplane anyway, because the stories get bigger and they get bolder. But the message, people can pick up on the message. But I really think that if we can teach people what we've learned, because the first flight training syllabus was developed in 1917 in World War One. And I've done a lot of research into how that was developed. And it really hasn't changed that much since 1917. So there's a couple of rewrites. But yeah, that's a whole nother beer and chip story. But I get great enjoyment from somebody comes in and they say, I want to learn to fly. And they don't know the pointy end from the from the blunt end. And then at the end of it, they're walking around saying, oh, yeah, you know, got to watch that stick position, or you got to, you know, oh, don't load, keep that ball in the middle, you know, like, you know, just give me a chill.
Give you the chills.
It just does. That's cool. Young guy came from Perth to do a tailwheel endorsement with us, and we did. Supposed to be 2 days, but he was having a few troubles with the wheelers, and And I said, look, man, we need to do a bit more. And he goes, oh, yeah, but I got to go home soon. And I said, mate, I don't want to sign you off until you know how to land this aeroplane properly as per the syllabus and to keep you safe. We get out of the aeroplane sweating and this is like, oh, yeah, that was hard work, but we got it. And he went home and he wanted to tow gliders. And just last week, he sent me a picture standing in front of a Pawnee and he's got a big smile on his face. And he wrote to Karen and I and said, here's a photo of me in front of the Pawnee. I got the opportunity to fly the Pawnee and all the gliding club tug pilots were around the pie cart and they probably had scorecards, but I did three circuits, three wheelers, three greasers, and they got on the radio and said, you can stop showing off now. No more free flying for you. Bring it back. And when I get feedback from that,
that's
amazing. And just one more story, if I may.
Oh, please.
This is why I do it. Like I'm getting chills here now. The reason why I do it is because when people feedback, we help people get jobs and stuff like that. And then they just send us, you know, tag us in a picture and stuff like that. Thanks for your help. Couldn't have done it without you. That's gold.
Yeah.
You know, but we had one fella, he wasn't a young fella. He was about my age and he used to be in the Royal Navy flying Harrier jump jets. And he was in the Falklands conflict. Very unassuming gentleman. It wasn't until we got to the beer and chips that he started to loosen up.
Yeah.
He was saying, I'm really loving this attitude flying. Because when we do the tailwheel endorsement, you get one flight with the airspeed indicator and the rest of the time it's covered up. You don't fly with the airspeed indicator at all. And probably about a year ago now, because he did it a number of years ago, probably about a year ago, he sent me a one-line email. He said, hey, Paul. Just a short note to let you know, I went night flying at Archer Field the other night. And on the third circuit, I had a total electrical failure and it was dark. So I lowered the nose of what I thought the attitude was. And I pulled the power back to what I thought the engine sounded like at 2300, performed an uneventful circuit and a full stop landing. Just wanted to let you know, you probably saved the day.
Wow.
My heart was in my mouth. I got tears in my eyes and I'm just like, holy crap, that's why I do this.
That's incredible. I want to talk to that guy.
Yeah, actually, I can put you in contact with him because he's got some awesome stories. He still flies the glider tug here time to time.
Okay.
But yeah, really nice guy. For me, if teaching people to fly safely and helping them understand what's going to happen if you get outside the 11%, now people who have done upset recovery training, they should understand what the 11% means, because when we're taught to fly, we're only taught to fly the airplane within 11% of its capability. All right. So the airplane's capable of a lot of things, but what happens when you get outside the 11%? Things can get funky if you don't do things appropriately. So upset prevention recovery training is not about the recovery itself. It's not about being in the airplane. We run workshops. It's a 3-day workshop. You get 2 hours in the airplane. 3 full days, 2 hours in the airplane. And you can do more, but that's the minimum. That's our basic course. And we talk a lot about how do you fly the airplane? How do you use stability? How to identify when things are going sideways and what to do so that, you know, that old adage, the superior pilot uses his superior knowledge to avoid the need for the use of his superior skill.
It's all about the prevention.
It's all about the prevention. If you can identify it's not going to happen, you don't need to be the hero. And for me, if I spend the rest of my days troubleshooting people and saying, hey, I think, and again, I'll caveat there that this is just what I've picked up over 40 years. I don't think you should be moving the stick around like that when you're at a low airspeed because this can happen. I had a guy, we were doing the training here, been flying for 25 years, had 1,000 hours, and I showed him some stuff. And one of the things that I showed him was that the tailplane creates a downforce to balance the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked me in the eyes like it was deer in the headlights. And I'm like, you okay? He said, why didn't anybody tell me that 25 years ago? You've got no idea how many questions that answers. Now, to be honest, to be true, and to be fair, that when you're learning to fly, it's like drinking from a fire hose, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole bunch of information coming in and that's why it's important to have a culture of the learning never ends.
Oh, 100%.
Because if you think you know it all, then you're setting yourself up Yeah. You know, you're an accident waiting for a grid location, right?
Yeah. So awesome to hear your perspective and your experience. And I think for me, the big takeaway is that satisfaction that you get out of seeing your passion save lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to round out the episode, I want to ask a few questions that everyone's going to get asked.
Okay, here we go.
Can you tell us about a memorable experience you had flying a particular aircraft and what made it special to you?
So there's lots, but this one from an instructor's point of view is about people's egos.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am, 19 years old, learned to fly a glider, and I wanted to be an instructor. So I'm doing an instructor training course in gliders, and I'm 19, 10 foot tall and rocket proof, and I'm in the Air Force, and I'm rah, 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 let's do this. And this always stuck with me as an instructor. I'm sitting in the back seat of a glider, and in the front is the, you know, the cranky old test instructor, and we take off on aero tow, and we're getting pulled across the fence at the end of the runway. And, you know, the biggest thing that all instructors want to do is pull the power on somebody, right? So, yeah, well, I get to pull the power on somebody. All those instructors all those years were pulling the power on me, and now I have the power to pull the power, you know. But in a glider, you don't have a throttle, but we've got a release.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about what are you going to do if the engine fails, or what are you going to do if the rope breaks.
Mm.
Right? So here I am, 19 years old, going across there, and I'm the big instructor. And I said to the test instructor in the front, "So, John, where would you go if the rope broke now?" And he said, "Stuffed if I know." And then he reached forward, pulled the release, and he goes, "Your controls." So I grabbed the controls and we landed in a paddock, and it was like the adrenaline was pumping and the heart's in my mouth, and so obviously I did it okay because I did the landing, otherwise he would have took over.
Yeah.
So I'm just like a bucket of soup in the back seat. The canopy opens and he climbs out, and he just nonchalantly leans on the side of the aeroplane and looks me square in the eyes and goes, "Don't ever ask the question unless you've got the answer." So that would be one of the most memorable flights.
Very memorable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for sharing that. Can you tell us what is one of your most fear-filled flight experiences?
One of the more recent ones, I was towing a banner in the mall, so 235 horsepower, and I'm towing this banner. It was just out over Samford, and it was a pretty windy day, and the target was around the Samson Valley area, and, you know, you get taught about the lee of the hills and the adiabatic and katabatic winds and all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And I thought I was pretty far away, but I must have hit some descending wave or something like that. And I had full power, and I'm still going down. And I'm going, I'm going to have to get rid of the banner. Otherwise, I'm not going to climb, because there's like buckets and buckets of drag out the back.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a mall will climb at 80 knots, almost, you know, 40 degrees.
Wow.
Nose pitch up. It will just climb. But I had full power with this banner on, and I was still going down. And I was flying at 60 knots. Otherwise, you shred the banner. And I'm turning left and turning right and trying to find where is this air mass not going down. And I was eyeing off a park with some power lines going across it. And all I could think in my head is, I'm going to pull the banner. It's going to drape across these power lines, black out southeast Queensland. And I hopefully the aeroplane's going to climb away. And then I hit this almighty thermal and push me down in the seat. Next thing you know, I'm at 1500 in the blink of an eye. And just like, oh, man, you know, that was pretty fear-filled. And then I actually did a video. See, all my scary bits are about banner towing, but it's normally quite benign. there's a video on Bad Attitude Facebook feed where I had four upsets in this flight. I was flying down the highway with a banner on board at 1,200 feet, and all of a sudden I had 90 degrees angular bank with about 10 to 15 degrees nose pitch up. With a banner on the back. It was just boom, gone. And I'm just like, holy crap, and appropriate recovery. And I think about all of the research that I did. I'm 60 knots, high angle of attack with flap, with a bag of drag on the back. And here I am 90 degrees at 1200 feet with a 10, 15 degrees nose up attitude. I got to get this right immediately. If you didn't learn all that stuff, it would have been 6 o'clock news stuff.
Got another question for you. Actually got two more. If you were given an expense-free opportunity to be endorsed on any airframe, what would it be?
This old chestnut.
Yeah.
Okay. Pilatus Porter.
Ah. Why is that?
What an amazing aeroplane. Just the performance of it, you know.
PT-6. High wing, tail dragger.
Stall, take off and land in its own length.
Yeah.
Descend vertically in beta.
Did you get to work on any of those in PNG?
No. Never touched one in the flesh. I often think, how many letters in a banner could I pull with a PT-6 flying at 60 knots? Yeah, that would just be.
That's cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Very cool. Last question. This is a really good question to ask you. What advice would you give someone who is just starting out in aviation, and what resources or support systems would you recommend they seek out?
Welcome aboard. The journey never ends. Seek out people who will give you value for money. Don't look for cheap. Be cautious of people that are just out there to take your money. And when you're looking for a flight instructor, find somebody that you click with. Might not be me, might not be Karen, might be somebody else. Doesn't matter. You need to have a relationship with your flight instructor and take bits of information from everybody and formulate your own picture. But have safety above everything. Safety and compliance, because the rules are written in blood. Mm. They're there for a reason.
It's been an amazing chat, and there's so much in there to learn. I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
I can only see it going in good places for the aviation community. People can find you, flyingscience.com.au, Google, YouTube, Facebook, Bad Attitude,
Advanced
Flight Training.
And Strike Aviation Training.
And
strikeaviationtraining.com.au.
If you are in Southeast Queensland, you know where Caboolture is. There's a beautiful airstrip here, two runways, very, very scenic. I've done a few flights over the top of Caboolture. I've never landed here.
We have to fix that.
I took a friend from Toowoomba once, and we flew down to the Glasshouse and we carved around the mountains a bit. And then he wanted to fly down the coast, so I had to climb up to get over to Moreton. And I basically came over the top of Caboolture and then circled up, and we went over to Moreton. And
right.
It was an amazing flight. If you haven't flown in this area, it is just stunning.
We are lucky.
Yes. So come pay a visit to Paul and Karen.
Yeah, pop in, say g'day.
So thank you very much, Paul. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in to the High Fly Media podcast with guest Paul Strike. Hope you've enjoyed listening to Paul's insights and experiences, and very importantly, could feel of his passion in teaching and upskilling pilots in the area of upset prevention and recovery training. Join us next time for more fascinating discussions. Subscribe now on your favourite podcast platform, and if you'd like to help out, feel free to leave a review. That'll help spread the word. Alternatively, you can listen to the podcast on the High Fly Media YouTube channel. The High Fly Media podcast, uncovering the people and passion behind aviation, one story at a time.